True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
You know, family life is not always rooted in love. For the blended family of Leith and Bonnie von Stein, life was marked by disappointments, resentment, and deep-seated hate. One summer night back in 1988, Bonnie and Leith were viciously attacked in their own bed. Daughter Angela said that she'd slept through the attack. Son Christopher was away, living in student housing at North Carolina University. The primary investigation led to Christopher and his Dungeons and Dragons playing friends. During this era of satanic panic, there was a public perception that the brutal attacks were a real-life manifestation of the role-playing game. At the Quiet End today, we're looking into the dark heart of family life in a small southern town. It's a terrifying story of greed and callousness, and the story of a mother forced to consider the worst about her own son. So I've been looking forward to covering this case for a while. We've covered several cases about kids killing their parents, but this one's a little bit different.
Well, it's certainly a little more chilling to me.
Well, it's certainly very brutal.
Yeah.
And the time when it happened in the late 1980s was an interesting time, with these role-playing games just really, you know, kind of being new and a big thing.
Yeah, I played some Dungeons and Dragons with one of my coworkers. He was really into it. I would put it this way, I was less into it.
Yeah.
I guess I didn't have the right imagination or the role-playing stuff. It wasn't much fun.
Well, and I think maybe it's not as big now that there's Fortnite and all that kind of stuff. Because this is more of a board game and an acting out game.
Yeah, I had pretty much forgotten about D&D.
So what have we got for a beer?
We got a nice beer. It's called The Event Horizon, which has something to do with astrophysics or the universe or something. But it's a cool name. It's brewed by Old Hickory Brewery, and it's an Imperial Stout, 11.75% ABV. Kind of a heavy hitter.
Nice. I'm in the mood for a heavy hitter today.
I've been in the mood every day.
Yeah.
So the beer is almost a black color, very, very dark brown. Small head, a little bit of lacing. Aroma is kind of a boozy chocolate. And then the taste is chocolate, bourbon, and amazingly to me anyway, some honey. It's a medium-bodied beer. I think the alcohol was hidden pretty nicely, so you're not really aware of that degree of alcohol until you try chugging a few.
It'll sneak up on you.
Yeah, so let's share it and sip it, as we say.
All right, let's open it up first.
Okay.
Okay, Dickie, we're already kind of in our little quiet end here, so no movement necessary except hand me a beer.
I'll pass it over to you. And I'll just say, once again, we have our puppy in here with us at the quiet end, and if you hear some chewing noises, he's eating a bone.
Yes. Not a real bone, a vegetarian chew thing.
Right.
Yes.
Okay, so in a North Carolina suburb in the early morning of July 25th, 1988, Bonnie von Stein awoke to an intruder at her bedside holding a knife and a club. Bonnie was severely beaten and stabbed, but she somehow managed to stay alive and call for help after the intruder had left. Leith was not so lucky, however. He was stabbed and bludgeoned to death. When investigators learned that his estate was worth over $2 million, naturally, his wife and stepchildren became suspects.
Yeah, the amount, I've heard varying stories on the amount, but it was around $2 million. So a considerable amount of money, especially in the 1980s.
It was.
The von Stein family lived in this small town of Washington, North Carolina. And the rest of the state calls this town Little Washington to differentiate it from Washington, D.C. and Washington State. But I guess the people who lived there like to call it the original Washington because it is the first town to be named after George Washington.
Really?
So that's an interesting tidbit for you.
Can we fact check that?
I have done that, but okay. If you want to double check for me.
So it was the first town?
As far as we know, yep.
Okay.
So whether you call it Little Washington or Original Washington, the town was virtually destroyed in 1864 and then again in 1900 by some devastating fires. A few homes survived and it was rebuilt, and it became a farming and fishing community. So with a population of just over 10,000, pretty small, it's known as a sleepy town, but actually a pretty good place to raise your family. Low crime.
I would imagine. 10,000 is pretty small, but not too bad. So yeah, it'd probably be a nice place to raise a kid.
Yeah, I think so.
So Leith was born in Queens, New York in 1946 to parents who both came from well-off German families. And when he was still a baby, the family moved to North Carolina. His father, Howard, was a graduate of Brown University, and he'd been a professional saxophone player before fighting in World War II. After the war, the big band era was starting to be on its way out, and it was getting hard to find work as a saxophonist. So at this point, he had a wife and a baby boy to support, so Howard decided he needed to find a steady job. He ended up taking one offered by his brother-in-law as a laundry equipment salesman.
Yeah, and I think he was successful at that, but maybe not at his happiest, right? Because he was an artist, a musician.
Yeah.
But he was successful.
I can see that happening. You're good at what you do, but your heart's just not totally in it.
Exactly. So Leith's mom, Marie, doted on him. She spoiled him and gave him pretty much anything he wanted. But, you know, he remained respectful and loving and had a good work ethic. By the time he was in high school, the Camel City Laundry and Cleaners had become one of the most successful laundries in the whole country. And Leith's dad, Howard, had become part owner, and they were employing over 100 people. But, you know, Leith had no interest in the laundry business, and his dad totally understood that. So Leith never took a part-time job that his father offered him at the laundry. He had decided on another career.
Yeah, Leith was accepted into the School of Engineering at North Carolina State University. He was successful for the first 2 years, but then in his junior year kind of lost his motivation and slacked off. He got into partying pretty heavily, and he flunked out in 1967. Now, the problem with this, or at this time, is that the Vietnam War was going on. So guess what happened to old Leith? He's drafted.
Yeah, his parents were pretty frantic and worried about this, as you can imagine.
Oh, yeah.
Their only son, their only child. So he was 21 years old by this time. And fortunately for him, his 2 years of college helped him get assigned to clerical work. So instead of being sent off to fight a war, he was stationed in an office in Germany. Of course, he knew some German, so that came in handy too. After his discharge from the army in 1970, Leith returned home and enrolled at Guilford College in Greensboro as a business major. Guilford was a small Quaker college, so some faculty and students held weekly silent vigils against the Vietnam War on the federal courthouse lawn. And Leith was agreeing with them. He didn't think this war should be going on.
Yeah, a lot of us at that time didn't think that was a good idea.
Sure.
To be in that war.
Absolutely. It was a movement. So although he had been conservative for most of his life, Leith did get some strong opinions against the war. And he let his hair grow out to his shoulders, started wearing blue jeans, and he got a pair of those small, round, wire-rimmed glasses that John Lennon had made really popular.
Oh, those damn hippie glasses.
And he often went without shaving. And of course, he smoked himself some marijuana. And his old friends teased him, calling him the weird hippie.
Now, his parents had no problem whatsoever with his hippie look. He was an intelligent, well-spoken adult, and they respected his opinions. Computers at that time were pretty new, and Leith became fascinated with them during his time at Guilford. After he graduated, he got a job working with computers at Intigon, which was an insurance company in downtown Winston-Salem. So he cut his long hair, traded his scruffy look for business suits, and began trying to make it in corporate America. At Intigon, he met Bonnie, who also had an interest in computers. Now, she was 2 years older than Leith, had recently separated from her husband, and was the mother of two young kids.
Well, maybe she wasn't the ideal woman his parents would want him to hook up with, but they did end up liking her. Bonnie was from a more working-class situation. Her father was a brick mason, while her mother stayed home with her three sisters and a brother. And they had a big country home. The house was surrounded by forest and some tobacco farms. The extended family was close, and she had several caring aunts and uncles in her life. Now, she and her family were Christian, and they were members of a local Methodist church, so that was also a big part of their life. Bonnie herself wasn't especially pretty. She was kind of on the thin side, and she wore eyeglasses, and kind of like me, she preferred the company of animals over people.
That sounds exactly like you.
And in high school, Bonnie worked on the school newspaper, and she was a member of the library and dramatics clubs. 2 years after she graduated, she began working for Intigon.
Now, in 1967, Bonnie got married to a man who was 5 years younger than her. His name was David Stephen Pritchard. After a short honeymoon, Bonnie went back to work, and David returned to high school. She's really robbing the cradle.
Kind of, yeah.
He returned to high school to finish his senior year. Now, her parents helped them buy a small ranch home just 2 miles away from them. In 1968, their first child, Christopher, was born, and then they had a daughter, Angela, in 1970.
So I have no proof of it. I wasn't able to find out, but it sounds like Bonnie got pregnant by David, and they decided they had to get married because they were very religious.
Okay, I mean, if they got married in 67 and the baby was 68...
Sure.
Possibly.
Well, yeah. If they got married in the summer of 67, and he was born in the winter or spring of 68.
Sure, I can see that.
It's absolutely possible. Because I just wonder why an 18-year-old boy would get married otherwise.
Why an 18-year-old boy would get married to a 23-year-old woman.
Yeah.
I mean, that's true.
Yeah, so I think that might have happened, but like I said, I don't know. They did stay together long enough to have a daughter, Angela, 2 years later in 1970. No big surprise, the marriage didn't work out. And soon Bonnie was complaining that her husband was immature and couldn't keep a job.
Well, he's still a teenager.
Yeah. Well, that's what happens when you marry a high school boy, yeah. But after they separated, Bonnie said that she and her children had been abandoned by David. Not sure what went on with that. But with financial help from her family, she was able to stay in the house. It was a struggle for her to pay all of her bills, but her parents, aunts, and uncles helped her with watching the kids, so she did have significant support.
Yeah. Leith was an intelligent, well-spoken man, but, like Bonnie, he wasn't especially good-looking, and he wasn't very popular with women. He did go out on dates, but he didn't talk about most of the women he was seeing. His friends and family, in fact, didn't find out he was dating Bonnie until things were really pretty serious between them.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's just generally how he was, or if he was ashamed of her or didn't think his parents would approve. That's another thing I'm not sure of, but I have my own ideas about it.
Well, I think we can look at our own family, look at our youngest son. I mean, we didn't know he was dating this young lady till he was taking her to the prom. He said, hey, I need to get a tux for the prom.
Yeah.
And then we find out, oh, yeah, you've been dating.
Yeah, well, yeah, kind of keeping it secret.
Yeah.
So I think that's more a boy thing maybe than a girl thing.
Okay.
Not sure. But Leith worked at Intigon designing forms on computers for about 3 years. But then he soon found the work really boring, which I can imagine. I mean, any kind of business to me is like, oh, what a drag. Although the podcast business, that's an exception. But he resigned in September of 1975 and took a traveling job as an internal auditor for a conglomeration of department store chains, and that was headquartered in Cincinnati. So he moved into an apartment across the Ohio River in Kentucky. Then Leith left that position in 1977, and he moved to South Bend, Indiana, to become a traveling auditor for a financial services company, And during his 2 years in Cincinnati, Leith had kept in touch with Bonnie. After working in Indiana for 2 years, he came home for a visit, and he told some friends he was thinking about marrying Bonnie, which was a bit of a shock because they didn't know anything about her.
They didn't even know she existed.
Well, some might have, but yeah, they didn't know he had a girlfriend.
Right. So Bonnie and Leith got married in August 1979. She gave up her job at Indigon, and she and her two children moved into a house with Leith in a suburb of South Bend. At that time, Chris was 10 and Angela was 9. Leith continued to travel for his job after they were married, but was able to be home for most weekends. Now, he used that time to try to bond with his new stepchildren.
Yeah, and I don't know if he really knew how to do it. It just didn't work out. It seemed like he tried to buy them things and encourage them, and it just never really paid off. There was always an issue between him and those kids.
Yeah, particularly the son.
Yeah, and I mean, they weren't little. They were already 9 and 10, so he only had a few years before the dreaded teen years.
Right.
Which are so tough anyway.
Exactly.
But when Leith's company moved its headquarters to Dallas, he wanted to go back home, so he started looking for a new job in North Carolina. And that was fine with Bonnie. She would like to be back there, too, at the time.
Yeah, so in the spring of 1981, Leith took a job as the head of internal auditing at National Spinning Company in Washington, North Carolina. The family all moved to Washington in July of 1981 and moved into the modern two-story frame house at 110 Lawson Road in Smallwood. Leith had traveled during his first 2 years in Washington, but after that he began working in a plant on the western end of town.
Yeah, and in 1983, Bonnie took a new job teaching data processing at a community college, and that was in nearby Martin County. The following summer, she went to work as a program analyst at an appliance factory only a few miles from her house. And this was kind of unusual. She was a bit ahead of her time. Computers were new, and it was certainly a male-dominated field. Leith's dad, Howard, sold his company to a big Texas company and retired. But just 3 years later, he died of an aortic aneurysm, leaving Leith's mother a pretty significant estate. But then she died a few months later from emphysema and other health issues. So everything was left to Leith.
Yeah, that must have been difficult, though. I mean, within a few months, you lose both your parents.
Yeah, and they weren't terribly old.
No.
No.
Now, Leith was understandably depressed after losing both his parents in such a short time. With his newfound wealth, he decided it was time to change some things about his life.
I think so. I don't think he was really happy. I think he kind of, you know, life happens and you make decisions, and he never really was able to follow any passions. So I don't think he was very happy, even though he was successful, kind of like his dad.
Right, exactly. So even though he was doing okay, he never really loved this job and probably felt like life was passing him by.
Yeah, he's middle-aged now. And what does he have to show for it?
A wife and two stepkids.
That's right. Which isn't horrible, but I just don't think he was terribly happy just from reading things that his friends said about time leading up to then and talks they'd had with him.
Well, it sounds like he had definitely fallen into a rut.
Yeah, and he was worried about his health. He'd really put on a lot of weight. I guess he was only 5'6", so at 170, 180 pounds, he was getting portly.
Yes, he would be.
And he'd always been, you know, slender and athletic. He was drinking too much because he wasn't very happy, and he wasn't exercising either. So within months of his mother's death, he took out a life insurance policy on himself for $350,000.
So then whenever Leith would visit old friends from high school and college, he rarely talked about his relationship with Bonnie. But he did talk about his stepchildren. It seemed there was always some tension between Leith and the children, especially between Leith and his stepson, Chris. And when Chris had gotten into his teens, the relationship got increasingly difficult. So Leith said to one friend, "It's hell trying to raise teenagers. We don't know what to do with Chris. He's just not interested in anything." Because for Leith, respect for his parents and a strong work ethic were quite ingrained. So it's difficult for him to understand a teen who didn't have the same values.
Yeah, he was really struggling with Chris, who was really given everything he wanted and showed no appreciation. Leith looked forward to a time when both of Bonnie's kids would be grown up and on their own. And that was coming right up, because in the fall of 88, Angela would be in college in Greensboro. And if Chris didn't flunk out, he would be back at North Carolina State for his sophomore year. Leith and Bonnie would be alone, and he planned to quit his job and just kind of start over.
Yeah, because he could do that.
Yeah.
So in the early morning of July 25th, 1988, Washington was a quiet place. For the police, it had been an unusually slow night. Central Communications took the calls for 7 rescue squads, 16 fire departments, the Beaufort County Sheriff's Department, and the Washington City Police. But on that night, only a handful of calls had come through.
Michelle Sparrow was working dispatch that night. Her husband was a policeman at the same location, and Michelle didn't normally answer the calls, but someone had called out sick. So she had agreed to work the 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. shift. And she didn't really mind because her husband was working the same shift and they'd only been married a few months. So it's still kind of that honeymoon period where she was happy to be with him. So the phone rang at 4:24 a.m. and it was Bonnie Von Stein. Her voice was weak and difficult to hear, and Bonnie said that it was an emergency. She needed the police and an ambulance at 110 Lawson Road.
Yes, she said there was an intruder who could still be in the house, and she and her husband were dying. They'd been beaten and stabbed, she said. Leith was on the bed and wasn't responding to her. She was on the floor, and she had a large wound in her chest. Her daughter Angela was in the house in her bedroom, but Bonnie did not know where she was at that point or if she'd been attacked also.
Things like this just didn't happen in Washington. And the Von Steins lived in, really, the nicest suburb in the region, Smallwood. People living in Smallwood didn't have intruders come in and beat and stab them in the night, which was a desirable thing in a neighborhood, right?
Absolutely.
So this whole attack was nearly inconceivable.
Yeah, it just doesn't happen. For the Von Steins, that weekend wouldn't have been out of the ordinary, but Chris had come home Friday night unexpectedly. He hadn't been home hardly at all during the summer, so Bonnie was pleasantly surprised when Chris called to say he was driving up from Raleigh, where NC State is, to see them. She had a close relationship with Chris through his childhood, and he'd been away at college for almost a year, and she worried about him. Well, sure, that's the parent's job, right?
Unfortunately, yes.
She called him often to make sure everything was okay. Bonnie was certainly a worrier when it came to her two kids, and she worried whenever Chris was on the road, because she knew he drove too quickly and didn't seem to be that safe a driver.
Yeah, and let's face it, Chris was getting into some trouble with drugs and things, too. On the weekends when Chris had come home during the past year, he either brought some college friends with him or he spent time with old high school friends who were still in town. Bonnie had no expectations that she would spend much time with her son that weekend, but, you know, she was comforted just to know that she would see him. So he showed up late on Friday, and after giving Bonnie a hug, he hurried out to visit friends. He was going to walk along the mall and the waterfront. He stayed out late, but everything had seemed okay. Now, he'd caused Bonnie and Leith a lot of worry recently. After a really shaky first year at North Carolina State University, he'd had to change his major, got a part-time job, and then he enrolled for both sessions of summer school to try and make up for things.
Yeah, he pretty much bombed the first year.
Yes.
So he needed summer school to stay on track.
And it didn't seem like he was really devoting that much to that either.
No, probably not.
Although he'd had a problem with his class in the first summer session, his parents were still hopeful that he was making some positive changes on the second session. So that Saturday, he didn't get up until about 9. After eating, he announced that he was going to check out the town, and he left. Bonnie had some errands to run that morning, and then afterward, she and Leith drove 20 miles to Greenville to have a late breakfast at the Waffle House. This is something they did pretty much every weekend. Then they had stayed for a while in Greenville to look at mobile homes. They were planning to buy one and put it in a nice wooded trailer park where Leith could use it as an office. And when they got back home early Saturday afternoon, Chris was still out, and his sister Angela, who just graduated from high school, had gone to the beach for the day with a girlfriend. So later on Saturday, Bonnie was concerned that Chris had written a check to buy drugs from an old high school friend.
And how'd she find out about that?
The parents had called her, and Leith was really upset and angry, as you can imagine.
Oh, sure.
They confronted Chris about it after he came back later that afternoon, and he claimed that the friend had helped him with some work at school, so he'd written him a check to pay for his time. But Leith didn't believe that.
I wouldn't either.
Chris really had a history of lying to them anyway. Earlier that month, he told them a story about why he was missing from school for several days. And Bonnie had called the campus police and reported him missing, so that was a whole big thing.
It
happened just a few weeks earlier.
Yeah, he was doing stuff in the recent weeks that made Bonnie and Leith wonder if he was using drugs. And then when this check issue came up, they were angry because they thought that their fears were justified. But they settled down and they talked to him about it. And it turns out, at least as far as they could tell, it was only marijuana, for which they were happy, I guess, in a sense.
Well, they thought it could have been worse, and in their younger days, they had used marijuana.
Right. Damn hippies.
Yeah.
Now, that evening, Chris grilled hamburgers for dinner, and they seemed to have had a nice time. Right after dinner, Chris said he needed to return to school to work on an important paper that was due Monday morning. Now, Bonnie tried to talk him into staying until Sunday, but he insisted on going back that night. So Bonnie walked him to his car, which was a classic 65 Ford Mustang that Leith had bought him for his 16th birthday. Now that's a gift.
Yeah, right? So that's what I'm talking about, while
yeah.
He was spoiled. When she was at the car, though, Bonnie did notice that there was a hole in the dashboard where the stereo should have been. And they had bought Chris a fancy stereo for Christmas. But Chris claimed that his car had been broken into at school and the stereo had been taken, and he didn't say anything because he didn't want to upset them. But, you know, even though Bonnie loved her son, she really couldn't trust him. And she couldn't help but wonder if Chris had sold that stereo to buy drugs or whatever.
Well, I tell you, I mean, all the signs point to that.
They do. They really do.
So Sunday morning, Bonnie and Leith were up early. This was the day before the home invasion and attack. Bonnie had decided not to tell Leith about Chris's car stereo because she knew it would upset him. They spent most of the day going through back issues of the Wall Street Journal and recording stock prices in their computer.
I can't really think of many things I would like to do less than that on a Sunday morning.
No kidding. Other than watching football or something like
that. Well, that would be just as bad for me, yes.
So, but, you know, the nerdiness. Bonnie and Leith had developed a program that was going to help them keep up with stock trends, and Leith was playing the market.
Well, yeah, I mean, I actually admire it. I wish I could be more like that. It's impressive that they put that kind of effort in.
Yeah.
In the past year, he'd come into this inheritance, and he wanted to invest it wisely, so that's a smart thing to do. He studied and made careful choices. But, you know, both he and Bonnie enjoyed that kind of thing. This was fun for them.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's like you and I doing things with the dogs or, you know, whatever. And it's just fun doing stuff
yeah,
together.
Right. That's just a thing we would never do.
Not that thing.
No. But afterward, they decided to drive back to Greenville and have a nice dinner. Leith was in a really good mood, and they talked about his success with the investments that he'd been making. And they were making future plans now that the kids would be in college. So, really kind of a good time for them. They had things to look forward to.
Yeah, although, you know, they're probably hoping, because the daughter's going to start college as a freshman. They've already had problems with Chris.
Yes.
So they're probably keeping their fingers crossed that he doesn't fuck up somehow and get kicked out of school.
Oh, sure. That was definitely a concern.
Yep.
Yeah.
So around 9 o'clock, they left for home. And The Deliberate Stranger, which is a two-part TV movie about Ted Bundy. I think we watched that, didn't we?
We watched it when we were interviewing, her name? The woman who had been attacked by Ted Bundy.
Yeah.
And it's Mark Harmon who plays Ted Bundy.
That was good casting, I thought.
I mean, for that time, it was a really good movie. And I'm just happy to see that she did have a little bit of that true crime in her that she enjoyed.
So Bonnie wanted to see it, and Leith wasn't that interested. He went to bed. Bonnie stayed up to watch it. And just before 11, Angela came home, and then she and Bonnie both went to bed within a few minutes. So Bonnie read for a few minutes, in bed before she turned out the light. Around midnight, she decided it was time to go to sleep, and then later on, she wasn't sure if it was the sound of the first blow hitting Leith or his first scream, but something woke her up.
Yeah, she only knew that she awoke confused in the dark and that her husband was screaming so loud that it just seemed to overtake the whole bedroom. He was trying to sit up, but he couldn't, and she couldn't help him. And she saw an intruder near the foot of the bed. It was dark, so this person was silhouetted in the light from the open bedroom door. And the man was tall and broad-shouldered, she would say. And she could see him raise a cylindrical object that was about 3 feet long, so maybe a pipe or a bat or something. And he swung it at them. But he didn't say anything or make any sound, so all she heard was the whoosh of air around the weapon and then a horrible thud when it struck one of them. And poor Leith was just struck again and again. Just 2 blows hit her, but they were heavy blows, and she was knocked onto the floor. The force of these blows actually caused her to slip into unconsciousness. And when she came to, she saw the shadow again standing at her feet with his arms raised. She was struck or stabbed again until she heard footsteps and the closing of her bedroom door. And she didn't know how long it was, how long she had been out this time, but she realized that she was on the floor. And at first she thought maybe she'd had a bad dream and fallen out of bed. But when she reached to get back in bed, Leith's hand was hanging from the side of the mattress and it was cold and sticky with blood. So she brought her hand to her head and she felt like a big gaping hole there. For a while she lay still listening, afraid that the intruder might still be there. She felt kind of reassured when she heard Leith breathing, but the breaths were growing fainter, and then she started hearing kind of a wet, raspy quality to his breathing, which is a really bad sign.
Probably not a good sign. Bonnie's own breathing was pretty difficult also, and when she tried to get up, she wasn't able to do that. She didn't feel any pain, but she knew that she was badly injured. Even in the dark, she could tell that her head was near the typewriter stand beside the bed, and the telephone was on a filing cabinet to her right. So she pushed herself across the carpet with her heels. When she finally got to the filing cabinet, she couldn't get up to reach the phone. She moved closer to an adjoining desk, found the phone cord, and pulled on it. So the phone fell onto her chest, and she tried to call 911. But then she blacked out again. When she woke up, the telephone was still on her chest. So she said, okay, think about this. So finally she was able to push 0, and she got an operator who transferred her to Michelle Sparrow at Beaufort County Central Communications Dispatch.
So the first officers to arrive at the scene entered through the back gate. They shined their flashlights on the house and saw the back patio door open with a broken window beside it. 2 officers entered the back porch, one carrying his .357 Magnum, and both shining their flashlights into the dark home. Through a window, they could see a light was on in the kitchen. It was the fluorescent light on over the kitchen sink. Cabinet doors were open under the microwave, and a woman's purse was on a stovetop that was built into an island in front of the sink. It was tipped over with its contents kind of strewn about. So the officers had made quick sweeps through the downstairs rooms, and they met at the foot of the stairs that led to the second floor. The intruder wasn't downstairs, so there were only 2 other possibilities. Either he had already left or he was waiting upstairs. So they had to be careful. They turned on a light switch at the base of the stairs and they both ran up. 1 door was immediately to the right at the top of the stairs and the door was shut, but Bonnie called out to them from inside the room. They couldn't hear her at first and they kept knocking on the door until she called out again. So once they opened the door into the room, it was completely dark, and they swept the room with their flashlights. And they would describe what they saw as the most horrible sight they had ever seen, even in years of police work. So the room was covered with blood, and lying diagonally across the bed face down was the body of Leith von Stein. He was wearing nothing but his cotton briefs, and they were saturated with blood. Several stab wounds were visible in his upper back and shoulder, and there was a huge, jagged tear right in the back of his head that was just bleeding like crazy, as head wounds do.
It was a mess.
Certainly.
Now, Angela was asleep in her bedroom at the other end of the upstairs landing, and she said she had not heard anything. I don't know. From what we've been described, quite a loud. I mean, he was screaming.
Yeah, I know.
So maybe to me it's a little hard to believe that she didn't hear anything.
Well, I thought that too, but then I also thought, you know, kids and teens are known for their ability to sleep through just about anything.
Yeah, that's true.
So it is possible.
So Angela was allowed to put on some shorts, and she was taken downstairs. When the paramedics arrived, Leith was pronounced dead. Bonnie was in pretty tough shape. She had lost a lot of blood. She had a sucking chest wound, which means that her lung had been punctured. This was no longer bleeding, but her blood pressure was pretty low. An IV got started, and a pressure dressing was applied to her chest, and they put on medical anti-shock trousers to slow the bleeding.
So those are like tight things, or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ultimate in compression.
So this just makes me think of cases where a spouse has been murdered and the other spouse has been injured. And it has turned out that it was the injured spouse who actually self-inflicted the wounds and killed their spouse. Some cases right off the top of my head, Charles Stewart in Boston. And of course, Darlie Routier.
Yeah, and don't forget Jeffrey McDonald.
That's a big one, right?
But in this case, I think she had a little more severe injuries.
Well, maybe. I think Charles Stewart had a pretty bad injury. He's the one that shot his pregnant wife and then shot himself and said that there were some black men who were trying to carjack them. And this was also in the 80s or 90s.
Right. That's true. But, Stewart either miscalculated or his wife moved at the time he pulled the trigger. Anyway, he injured himself more severely than he had meant to.
Yeah.
Again, Bonnie was in pretty tough shape. I guess I would look at this and say she's not a suspect. I know she is because she's a spouse, but she got banged up pretty good.
She did, yeah. I mean, as far as Jeffrey McDonald, he had actually inflicted his own wounds. He was a doctor, a surgeon, so he was able to do that pretty easily.
Yeah.
And that seemed like it was totally fake, at least in my opinion.
Well, in the McDonald case, I mean, if you look at what had happened to his wife and kids, and he had what turned out to be pretty minor injuries. So that's going to raise your suspicions right there.
Yeah, well, that's just a fascinating case, and I bet some people think it's been overanalyzed. But for some reason, I always enjoy learning more about that case.
It's a fascinating case.
It is. There's actually a new special about it on Hulu. If I could think of the name of it, I'd recommend it.
Yeah, well, it's about Errol Morris, who wrote the book that claimed to exonerate McDonald.
Yeah. Yeah, if you look up Errol Morris on Hulu, you'll find it, or maybe even on FX On Demand, but we've watched 4 or 5 episodes, and that's pretty interesting. Even after reading the books and doing an episode, we've learned a little bit.
Absolutely. Great documentary.
Right. But we digress.
We do. Jill, what are you burning out here? Bodies?
Well, no. I'm throwing in all of our earbuds and headphones with a little bit of lighter fluid as my protest against podcast ads in my favorite shows. I'm just getting into a story or I'm dozing off and it's interrupted with commercials. I'm mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore.
Nice movie reference. Anyway, let's just simmer down here. You do know that our True Crime Brewery listeners have the option to subscribe to our premium show for ad-free episodes and bonus episodes, right? It costs as little as $4 per month, and these contributions help support the cost of producing TCB.
Well, of course. I love and appreciate our subscribers. You know, I worked for weeks with our IT girl to set that up, and all because I have a deeply held belief that our listeners shouldn't have to hear ads.
That's well said. Now, let me ask you this. How are we going to record this week's episode without our headphones?
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Well, you stay here. I'll go get the hose.
Okay, hurry. So Bonnie was severely injured, and she called for help. Help came. Leith was dead. Angela had slept through it.
Right.
So they had taken Angela downstairs. She's 17 years old, and she was sitting very calmly in the den. And some of the people who were first responders thought she was too calm. The police needed basic information for the preliminary report, and an officer wanted to get as much information as he could before he found out how bad things were with her parents and possibly lost control of her emotion. Before Angela found out just how bad things were with her parents and maybe she'd become really emotional. So the policeman told Angela that her mother had been stabbed, but that she was conscious and talking. Her stepdad, he told Angela, had been beaten and stabbed and was seriously injured. He didn't want her to learn about Leith's death yet, but he was really surprised that she was showing no reaction to what he was telling her. She just very calmly agreed to answer his questions. So Angela told this officer that she had a brother, Chris Pritchard, who was away at school at North Carolina State, and she asked if they wanted her to call Chris and tell him what had happened. And she was told, yes, go ahead and call him.
So her brother Chris called the campus security office at 5:17 in the morning from a campus emergency phone box at NC State. He sounded nearly hysteric, and he kept saying something about losing his keys and his parents being stabbed. He needed to go to Washington, North Carolina. Now, a campus police officer was sent to the phone box where Chris was standing in shorts and a T-shirt. His back was rested against the pole where the phone was mounted, and he had his knees pulled up with his head on his knees.
So this is before cell phones, and I think most kids in the dorm didn't even have their own phone. They either used these call boxes, or maybe they had one in the hallway. You're a little older. Do you know?
Well, I know my school. Yeah, we had a phone in the hallway. It was four dorm rooms shared the same phone.
Right. So when he got the call from his sister, from whatever phone was available, he had called from that phone box, and that's where the campus police found him.
Yeah.
But he did seem very distressed, much more distressed than Angela did.
Yeah, no kidding. So when the campus security vehicle stopped beside him, Chris jumped up and ran over to the car yelling. Chris was thin, average height, dark hair, but he had a really wild look in his eyes. And he seemed pretty agitated, and the officer couldn't understand what he was yelling at her about. I couldn't find my fucking car keys, he kept yelling. And he also kept repeating something about his parents being beaten and stabbed. As he's flailing his arms and pacing back and forth, a second campus security car arrived. And both officers thought that he was either drunk or on drugs or a combination of the two, and he might be hallucinating.
Sure, yeah. Now, if we're thinking that Chris is responsible for this, and, you know, we are, then I think his behavior is kind of melodramatic. But, you know, also he's probably thinking, oh, shit, they're not dead.
Well, does he know that at this point?
Well, his sister called and said they'd been stabbed and beaten. She didn't say they'd been killed.
Right.
So if he's behind the murder.
Yeah, that might make him anxious.
Yeah. Now, whoever had killed Leith von Stein had been very vicious and thorough. He was on his back, his eyes were swollen and closed, his beard was completely matted with blood, his left hand was clenched, and his entire body was literally covered in blood. He had 5 gaping wounds on his head and 6 stab wounds from a large bladed knife in his upper back near his left shoulder. Another knife wound in the center of his chest had gone straight into his heart. So the carpet was bloodstained on either side of the bed for at least 3 feet out, if you can imagine that. Blood was even splattered on the ceiling and on 3 of the walls in that room.
That's pretty gruesome.
Very gruesome. The intruder had entered and exited the house by the back porch door, but the broken window by the door was kind of a mystery. It had been broken from the outside because the glass was scattered on the beige linoleum of the porch floor. But why had the window been broken when the wooden door itself had 9 panes of glass? Would have been easier to break one of those and open the door. Also, a person would need really long arms in order to reach through that broken window and unlock that door. and also the cuts on the screen didn't match the breaks in the glass. So right away they're thinking it might have been staged to look like a break-in and a robbery.
Yeah, I mean, somebody could have entered with a key and broken the window just to try to make it seem like a break-in.
Yes.
And there was another strange thing. On the back porch, there was a faded military backpack on the floor next to a plastic garbage can. And it looked like it was obviously out of place. And there were two cabinets in the kitchen that were open, as well as two drawers. There were two purses on a countertop. The contents of another purse had been spilled across the stovetop in the kitchen island. There was a wallet, a folder of credit cards, and a small aspirin bottle that were spread over the stove also. The wallet and purses appeared to have been tossed through, but the detectives who worked the scene weren't convinced that robbery had been the motive, because there were many things left behind that a robber would likely take. Stereos, TVs, VCR, computers, a lot of stuff. There was a $20 bill and some coins that were in plain view on a dresser in the master bedroom. Lee's wallet and watch were also there. It looked like they had been untouched. Bonnie's wedding rings were in a small bowl nearby. So it doesn't look like robbery was a motive here.
No, and that is just overkill if that's the case. So, in the emergency room at Beaufort County Hospital, Bonnie was alert, but she was acting bizarre, as the ER doctor, Dr. Cook, would later describe it. "Is he dead?" Bonnie asked as the doctor worked on her wounds. "I'm glad he's dead. At least he's not suffering. He's out of his misery."
Weird.
It was weird, and it made them suspect her a little bit.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. Dr. Cook found three lacerations on Bonnie's head, two near the hairline at the center of her forehead, which were each about an inch long, another over her right eyebrow, and this one was larger and kind of C-shaped. Her most serious injury, though, was the one to her chest. Above her right breast, she had a bruise the size of a grapefruit, and just to the right of her sternum, there was a 2-inch stab wound. The knife blade had touched the sternum and cut right into her chest wall, and one of her lungs was partially collapsed. Dr. Cook ordered a transfusion, started an IV, and inserted a catheter into the chest to help drain the wound and allow her lung to reinflate. And Bonnie's breathing improved almost immediately after that.
At the public safety building at NC State, the police had managed to get the agitated Chris Pritchard calmed down enough to learn that his sister had called him in his dorm a little before 5 in the morning to tell him that their parents had been beaten and stabbed and that he needed to get home. But he couldn't find his car keys. So that's what he was yelling about at the phone box. He'd been so upset that he had left his dorm, not knowing what to do until he saw the call box and asked for help. Campus police told him they would try to find out what had happened to his parents. Then the head of security authorized two officers to drive Chris to Washington in a public safety car. The three of them left Raleigh about 6 in the morning. Chris said very little as they began the trip, and after about 15 minutes he fell asleep.
Yeah, so that was another thing that really didn't go over well.
No.
This is a crisis situation, which two people who should be two of the closest people to you have their lives in danger at least, right? And he's falling asleep.
And he's asleep.
So once they got to the Washington police station, Chris was told that his mother was seriously injured and that his stepfather was dead. He asked to go and see his mother in the ICU, and once there, he sat by her bed, holding her hand and crying. The detectives back at the house on Lawson Road had decided that Bonnie could still be in danger, and when word got out that she had survived the attack, the killer might return to finish her off, if she was a witness. So they immediately assigned officers to protect Bonnie. And by mid-afternoon, the Washington Police Department had already received many calls about this murder. Remember, this was very unusual in the area.
Yeah, and it's a small town, so everybody knows everybody's business.
Exactly. So some people who called were just curious and wanted more information, and others were afraid that there was a killer loose in their neighborhood. There were still others who called trying to help because they had some information, and some of these calls were important enough for the police to check into. Detectives went out to talk to the local sales supervisor at a large local bakery, and the man had driven down Lawson Road shortly before 4 o'clock that morning on his way to work. As he was leaving Smallwood, he said, he had seen a car turning into the development. It was a Japanese car, not particularly old or new. It was baby blue, and it had a luggage rack on top. He continued the story by saying there were two scroungy-looking young white men with long hair inside the car. The one on the passenger side was slouched in his seat with his knees on the dashboard. And the man knew that because his headlights had been shining directly into the car when it turned in front of him. But he couldn't tell what the men were wearing. Still, he'd been suspicious of the car, because this guy drove through Smallwood every morning on his way to work, and this was the first time he could remember seeing a car out in that area so early. His one regret was that he hadn't gotten the license plate number. So this was a guy who wanted to be a helpful citizen.
He certainly was. That's a big help.
Yeah.
Before the detectives could follow up on this lead, they first had to learn more about the people directly involved with the victims. And shortly after 4:30 that afternoon, they returned to the police department to meet with Angela and ask questions about the family's life. So the officers began by asking Angela to go over activities the day before, which she did, telling them everything up to the time she went to bed Sunday night. And then the next thing she knew, she said she was being awakened by a police officer. She had no idea that the attack was going on, as she had slept through it. She added that her mother was certain that if she hadn't fallen off the bed, she would have been killed too. Whoever had done it, her mother had told her, had to be young and strong.
Well, you know, Angela had very little information about her stepfather. She knew that his father, mother, and uncle had died recently and he had inherited some money, but she didn't know how much. She told them that her brother was in summer school at North Carolina State, and he would be a sophomore in the fall. Detectives really wanted to know how Chris got along with his stepfather, and she said they got along fine, and she didn't have any idea who might have wanted to kill Lee. The only thing she could think of was that it might be somebody he had fired at his business, but she didn't know whether he had fired anybody recently. The detectives came out of the interview with one potentially important piece of information, and that was that Angela had never seen that backpack that they had found on the back porch. She was sure that nobody in the family owned it, so there was a good chance that the killer had left this behind.
Yes, on the morning of the attack on the Von Steins, small farmer Noel Lee was up at 3:15. He drove his gray Chevy pickup to his hog house, which is just a short distance from his house. By 4 in the morning, he was done working at the hog house. He checked the automatic feeders, made sure that the pens were secure, and that all the lights were turned off. 10 minutes later, he was back in his truck heading home. But as he reached the road, he saw an orange light in the trees about half a mile away. So first he thought it was that a neighbor's trailer might be on fire, but he figured the fire was too close to the road to be the trailer. There had been car wrecks in that area before, fairly sharp curves, so that was his next thought. Now, Lee had been a volunteer fireman and rescue squad member for more than 20 years, so he turned back toward the fire. And once up close, however, he saw that the fire wasn't from a car.
No, just 8 to 10 feet off the road, beside a path that led to an old cemetery, there was a pile of something that was burning. Lee had taught fire science at the community college, and he could tell by looking at it that this fire was fueled by an accelerant, probably gasoline or kerosene. Also, he knew that it had been set just minutes earlier. But who would set a fire alongside an isolated country road in the middle of the night? It was very suspicious. So he approached the fire in his vehicle, but decided not to get out to investigate, because he got kind of a creepy feeling that whoever set this fire might still be there. The surrounding area was very swampy, and the roadside was still wet from a thunderstorm, so he decided he wasn't worried that the fire might spread. So he finally drove home, but he did keep thinking about this fire and how strange it was to see it there.
Now, the Von Stein murder remained a topic of conversation, obviously, in Washington, even after it stopped being on the front page of the local papers. Everybody had a theory about who had killed Leith. Bonnie's friend and neighbor, Peggy Smith, began keeping a list of the rumors and theories that were shared among the locals. Most of the rumors had to do with Bonnie and her two children. Well, sure. Here's a few of the thoughts. Bonnie was having an affair, and her boyfriend killed Leith. Leith had ordered Angela's boyfriend to leave the house and never come back. And he's the killer.
And he came back and tried to murder them. That was one of the thoughts.
Chris had been kicked out of the house after a heated argument with Leith.
Then he came back and did it.
Chris and Angela hated Leith, and they fought constantly. Angela, her boyfriend, and Chris did it to collect $1 million in insurance. Chris and Angela were on drugs, and they belonged to an occult group.
Well, this is that whole satanic panic era.
Yeah. The other one was Bonnie's injuries were all self-inflicted.
And that's one I'd have to consider before I could eliminate that.
Well,
anytime one spouse survives and the other's murdered and they're alone together, you have to at least suspect.
Sure. But she was pretty severely injured.
She was, and she would be eliminated. But it would take a little time for that to happen, and especially around town, there were suspicions.
Oh, yeah. Like we said, small town life.
Yeah, and while many of the locals remained fearful that the town had a killer who might kill again, many others just decided there was no serial killer loose in town, and they believed that the murder of Leith had been an inside job. It just seemed that way.
Well, they were right.
Yes. So Chris and Angela went to the Smallwood Summer Festival with friends on that weekend after the murder, which I find distasteful.
Well, it is. But it was just their stepfather. It wasn't their real father.
Yeah, well, obviously they didn't care much about him.
No.
But still, you think you would try and at least stand on ceremony a bit and not go out to a festival less than a week after he's murdered.
You would think so, wouldn't you?
And even if they didn't like this guy, he did a hell of a lot for them. They wouldn't have had the lives they had without him.
No, they certainly wouldn't have.
No. And when they were out at that festival, they were recognized, of course, and they were talked about, not in a good way.
I'll bet they were.
They really showed no signs of being upset or in mourning. So, inappropriate to a lot of people's way of thinking.
Yeah, it was. So on Saturday, detectives went to a local store to talk to a girl who had dated Chris. She said she hadn't had any contact with Chris since the previous fall, and that was when he came up to her at Burger King and hugged her neck. She had met Chris a couple years earlier on a blind date and had gone with him on a group trip to King's Dominion, which is an amusement park in Northern Virginia. She described the King's Dominion trip as a mistake, and according to her, Chris was not a gentleman. He couldn't or wouldn't keep his hands to himself. So this woman broke up with Chris after that trip. She said she had once visited the Von Stein house with Chris and some of his friends. Angela was there too, and this woman knew Angela, didn't like her either. So she's striking out with this family. She didn't know about any specific fights between the two and their stepfather, but she did know that they didn't like him, which seemed odd to her because Leith had given them just about everything they wanted.
Well, the sad part of parenting is that sometimes you give too much. It's difficult.
No kidding. I mean, it's a fine line to walk between being overindulgent and a good parent.
Well, and some kids you can give them everything and they respect you and appreciate it. And other kids are just never will.
Right.
And that seems like the way it was with Angela and Chris.
Yeah, I mean, this girl thought that it seemed that Angela and Chris expected everything from Leith, and in return, they didn't respect him. Now, she also went on to say that Chris was a strange guy. He talked all the time about a game called Dungeons and Dragons that he played with his friends Jonathan Wagner and Eric Smith.
Those were, I believe, his high school friends he played with, and then when he went to college, he played with some other kids. But he was just so deeply into it that he would dress up in costumes and act out the parts. And she also had been told that Chris was into drugs, including marijuana and cocaine, although she hadn't actually seen him use drugs, and some of his other friends would say cocaine was too expensive. They were more into marijuana and LSD. I don't know if that makes any difference.
Sure, we weren't doing the bad stuff. We were just smoking weed.
Well, that same day, the detectives talked to another young woman who was a friend of both Chris and Angela. and she'd heard from friends that Chris had just flipped out on that Wednesday night 2 days after the murder. Chris had told another young woman that he needed to talk to her in private, and he'd given her some notebooks with his writing in them. This young woman had also heard something about the murder. She had heard that Angela had a boyfriend who was an ex-con, and Leith had kicked him out of the house the night before the murder.
Yeah, there's one of the theories, right?
A rumor, really, yeah. A friend's mother had told her that. And they were thinking that maybe there was some kind of confession in the notebooks, but that ended up being nothing. So Bonnie was released from the hospital on Monday, August 1st. That was 1 week after Leith was murdered. She was interviewed again and questioned about friends of Chris and Angela this time. And police had heard that Angela had a boyfriend who could have been involved, but Bonnie had no knowledge of that. She didn't believe that. She did tell them the names of Chris's roommates at the university, but she also added that she had no concerns about Chris or any of his friends being involved. Then Bonnie remembered something had been taken from the house on the night of the murder. On Friday, she'd gone to the bank machine and withdrawn $100 in $20 bills. And she'd had one of those bills in a pocket and put it on the table in her bedroom Sunday night. But there was at least another $80 in the purse in the kitchen, and that was gone. But does that mean they broke in to steal things, or does it mean, by the way, I might as well grab this money?
Yeah, I think it was just the opportunity.
Sure.
So Angela and Chris were brought in to be fingerprinted that afternoon. And after Chris was finished, detectives took him aside to question him again. He has said he had driven to Washington that Friday night because he hadn't been home much during the summer, and he just wanted to visit. After he returned to Raleigh Saturday night to work on a paper, he ended up going out with a friend to look for a party. And when they didn't find one, they returned to the dorm room, his friend's dorm room, and drank beer.
So he doesn't seem very committed to turning things around at school.
Gotta get that paper done. Right?
Yeah, sure. He did say he worked on the paper for a little while, but he didn't finish it. And then Sunday night, he drank beer and played cards with friends until about 3:30 in the morning. So he wasn't real concerned about getting that done. Then he said that Angela had called him about 5 a.m., not long after he had gone to sleep. Chris said that he couldn't find his car keys, and he had left the room and ended up calling the campus police, who picked him up, and then they later brought him to Washington.
Detectives visited National Spinning Company and talked with Leith's co-workers. One told the police that he had talked with Leith on Thursday or Friday before he was killed, and recalled that Leith was upset about Chris and his studies. "If he doesn't make it this semester, that's it," the co-worker remembered Leith saying. "I won't pay for him to flunk out." Co-workers had heard nothing about problems between Bonnie and Leith, and they felt pretty certain that Leith didn't have any extramarital affairs.
Now, it's interesting that Bonnie didn't move back into 110 Lawson Road, and maybe it's because it was so traumatic she didn't want to go back there. She ended up moving to Winston-Salem in early August, and then she spent several hours talking with detectives one day when she returned to Washington for a medical checkup. That was on August 15th. That time, she offered up a possibility to detectives that they thought was just ridiculous. She said maybe somebody at the bank where Leith's trusts were held had instigated the murder because they were concerned he might be planning to remove all of his money from their bank.
Well, that's a big stretch.
That's ridiculous, really.
I'd be suspicious of that, too.
Of her saying that?
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, maybe she's just coming up with ideas.
Yeah, I guess.
It's a stupid idea, but we all have them.
Yeah, the detectives were interested in Leith's financial affairs, obviously. But that just made no sense, that idea. They knew that many people knew about Leith's inheritance, but what they really wanted to know was just how much Chris and Angela knew about the money. Leith's father had more than $1 million from the sale of the laundries in Winston-Salem, Bonnie said. But the only people who would have knowledge about it, she said, were his banker, his bosses at work, and a cousin who was a stockbroker and often gave Leith investment advice. So Bonnie talked about an incident involving her and Chris that had happened on the weekend of the murder. She had received a call from the mother of a young man near Raleigh to whom Chris had given a check. Chris and the kid had lied about it, but Chris later admitted to her that he'd given the check to the guy for marijuana.
Now, I'd like to know what drug dealer takes a check.
Yeah. Okay.
It's unusual.
So this young man was supposed to pick up some pot and deliver it to Chris, but he didn't come back. Chris had claimed to be afraid of another guy who hung out with this young guy, who he said was a drug dealer who owned a gun.
Yeah, so Bonnie's trying to offer up these people. And you kind of can't blame her. She probably doesn't think her son had anything to do with it. And she certainly doesn't want to think her son had anything to do with it. So she's trying to think of people who might have done it. But Chris owed a drug dealer money, and the dealer thought his parents were wealthy. The dealer might believe that if his parents died, Chris would receive money and be able to pay his debt. And even if Chris weren't involved in drug dealing himself and had only been looking for somebody to kill his parents so he could claim the inheritance, a former roommate who sold drugs and kept a gun might have made a good accomplice for him. So they had to look into that guy. But while Bonnie was talking about her son, the detectives remembered Bonnie's brother telling them about Chris turning up missing earlier in the summer. And they asked her about that incident. This had happened around the 1st of July, she said. She and Leith were planning to go to Winston-Salem for several days, and Angela and her girlfriend, Donna Brady, decided they wanted to stop off and spend the night with Chris at North Carolina State before going on to Winston-Salem the following day. So they had called and arranged to stay with Chris. But when they showed up that night, Chris was nowhere to be found, and none of his friends knew where he could be. So Angela and her friend Donna ended up spending the night in Angela's car, and then they drove on to Winston-Salem as they had planned to the next day. But Bonnie was worried when she learned what had happened, and she began to search for Chris. Because he hadn't even shown up at his part-time job, and his boss was also worried. So Bonnie searched for about a day and a half before she called the campus police and filed a formal missing persons report. Then, later that night, Chris called her from North Carolina State. Chris said that he had gone on what was intended to be a short trip to the mountains with a friend called Moog. And they were going to visit Moog's uncle. But on the way, he said, the fan belt broke on his car, and they went to some woman's house who gave them goat's milk and took them in. But then they got really sick from food poisoning. So what a stupid story.
Holy shit.
And this was, of course, a very lame story, very difficult to believe. And later on, Bonnie had learned that Chris and his friend had really been at her sister's house in South Carolina that entire time. Bonnie said that her sister's daughter had a girlfriend who Chris was dating, and he had gone there to see her. He'd asked his aunt not to tell Bonnie that he was there if she called. So Bonnie's sister had covered for Chris, and Bonnie said that she didn't hold it against her because her sister had had a lot of problems lately. We don't know what those were.
Boy, this is a lot of stuff.
But what a convoluted story.
I tell you.
Jeez.
The lie about his disappearance and the incident with the check had caused Leith to be more and more distrusting of Chris, she said. After Chris graduated from high school, the year before, Leith had gotten Chris a summer job at National Spinning Company, and he had been very proud of how Chris handled it. He had been proud that Chris wanted to study engineering, but then he was upset when Chris got low grades. So the only serious argument between Leith and her son that Bonnie could remember had been about Chris's study habits and his grades. But it hadn't gotten physical, but Leith had told Bonnie afterwards that she could deal with Chris from that point on.
Yeah, pretty much washing his hands of the guy. Well, the detectives learned that Chris showed up at a local pawn shop 4 days after the murder and sold his saxophone. So why did he need money? We don't know. Bonnie didn't know, and she was surprised to hear this. They brought up Leith's life insurance again, and Bonnie said that she had gone over the policies with her attorney, and the face value of the life insurance was only about $770,000, not a million. So a mere pittance.
Yeah, right.
The order of beneficiaries, she said, was first herself, second Chris and Angela, and third her parents. So there's a motive. That's a lot of money.
Yeah, well, except for the one tiny problem. Bonnie survived.
Yes, but I would suspect her before I eliminated her, because she's the primary beneficiary of this.
Okay. So on August 31st, detectives drove 23 miles north of Washington to talk to Stephen Prettyman.
Nice name.
He had dated Angela for 3 months that spring before she had caught him cheating on her with another girl. And they broke up after that, but they still talked. Prettyman said that he got along with Leith, but that Leith usually didn't like Angela's male friends. Leith seemed to get along better with Chris than with Angela, Prettyman said. But both of them used the same nickname for Leith, Asshole. Nice kids. Prettyman also said that he'd been told that Leith was worth $3 million. Angela had told him that Leith's parents were rich, and that when they died, their money went to Leith. Prettyman said he thought that whoever killed Leith knew the family, because he'd gone straight to Leith's and Bonnie's bedroom and hadn't disturbed Angela.
Well, sure. You know, I just wonder why Angela's telling peers about how much money Leith was worth. Of course, that doesn't look good.
Well, it's an interesting concept here.
Yeah, and it was kind of a joke with Chris and some of his friends at college about, are you going to knock off your parents soon? Because he was bragging about the wealth and what he was going to inherit. Which it reminds me of Bart Whitaker. And who's the other one with the airplane that killed his family? We did that a few months ago. We covered that case. But anyway, it's a similar situation. Someone who's bragging about the money they're going to inherit. So nearly 6 months later, there were still no arrests in this case. And Bonnie talked to detectives and agreed that she, Angela, and Chris were willing to take polygraph exams. So the exams were set for January 17, 1989, and the detectives had put off any further investigation pending the outcome of these tests. But when Bonnie met them at the office in Greenville that day, only Angela was with her. Chris couldn't come, she said, because he had an appointment with his psychiatrist. And when asked when Chris would be available, Bonnie said she didn't know. And then she said it would be his decision whether or not he took the exam. Now, by this point, Chris had dropped out of school and was getting therapy.
It turns out that Bonnie had sought out one of the best known and also most expensive defense attorneys in the state. This was Wade Smith of Raleigh, and he had helped defend Dr. Jeffrey McDonald against the charges of killing his wife and children. This attorney had advised Chris not to take the test. So the polygraph examiner asked three key questions of Bonnie and Angela. Bonnie, he said, or asked, did you plan your husband's death? Did you help plan your husband's death? Do you know who stabbed your husband? She answered no to each question. To Angela, the examiner asked, did you help someone stab Leith? Were you involved in stabbing Leith? Do you know who stabbed Leith? And Angela answered no each time. After studying the results of the tests, the examiner determined that both Bonnie and Angela were telling the truth. This result convinced the detectives that neither Bonnie nor Angela had had any role in Leith's murder.
Well, sure, but you know, Chris's reluctance to take the test had reaffirmed what they already were believing, that he knew who had killed Leith and attacked his mother.
Well, it's sure leading that way, isn't it? Here he's all set to take the polygraph exam, and his lawyer says no, and he's not going to do it. Yeah, I'm looking at him.
Well, after multiple visits to Chris's college dorm, detectives had learned that Chris was really into this Dungeons & Dragons role-playing game, and Chris often vented his anger to his fellow D&D players at the university. According to those who knew him well, Chris was bitter toward his stepfather for not spending more of his inheritance on him.
Well, sure. Wouldn't you be?
No. When pressured, some of Chris's friends told detectives that another student named James Upchurch and Neil Henderson, two other D&D players on campus, may have been involved in a murder plot with Chris.
Yeah, in fact, this was the information that led to a breakthrough in the case.
Yeah, after they spoke with Chris's friends, Neil Henderson confessed to investigators that he had driven another friend, James Upchurch, to and from the scene of the murder on the morning of July 25th. So they really hit pay dirt there.
Whoa, we're just confessing. All right.
So according to Henderson, Chris had promised to use his inheritance money to reward Upchurch and Henderson after his mother and stepfather were killed. So not only did he want the stepfather killed, he wanted his own mother killed, which is just brutal.
Well, he doesn't get the money unless they're both dead.
I know. Well, Neil Henderson spoke with detectives for 5 hours, and he told them everything he could remember about the night and morning of that murder. A week or so before the murder, Neil said, Chris and James had gone to Washington together to kill Chris's parents. He'd heard them talking about it, and they'd said something about putting Chris's family to sleep with sleeping pills before killing them. But they had apparently backed out because Chris decided it would be better for him not to be at home when they died.
Right.
I guess so.
Sure.
But before the weekend of the murder, Chris and James had come by Neil's apartment. James had said that they had come up with a plan for Chris to get his inheritance early. Neil didn't want his friends to think that he was afraid, so he agreed to help them. And James would carry out the actual killing, and Neil's job would be to drive him. Neil would be paid for driving, but he wasn't sure whether the amount would be $2,000 or
$20,000. Okay.
That's a big difference.
Just a bit.
That's a big difference, and the fact that he doesn't know and he's going to do it just makes me think he's a real follower, not the brightest.
No shit.
So only Chris's parents were to be killed, though, because Chris said he was willing to share his inheritance with his sister. So that was very generous of him.
It was, I think.
Well, yeah, those other cases I was talking about, they killed their sibling as well. But that inheritance, Neil believed, was about $10 million, so it had really been played up.
Yeah, you know, this is like that game where you do telephones.
Yeah.
Or whisper to somebody, and it starts out at, oh, yeah, there's $1 million inheritance. And by the time you get to the last person, oh, it's $10
million. Exactly, yes. So Neil had no idea how much James was going to be paid for doing the killing. But Chris had sketched out two maps. One showed how to get to his neighborhood. The other was a map that identified the Von Stein house. James was supposed to enter the house through the back door with a key that Chris gave him, and he was going to make the killings look like they were related to a burglary. Chris was to stay at school while the murders were taking place and make sure that people saw him so he'd have an alibi. If Chris received a call about the murders before Neil and James got back to Raleigh with his car, he would claim to have lost his car keys as an excuse for not being able to drive to Washington. And that is what he did. Before leaving that day, Neil said, Chris told him that his parents were about to disinherit him because he was flunking out of school. They were going to take away his money for school, and if he didn't kill them, he'd have to work full time. The horror.
Jeez, that's terrible.
The poor kid.
Yeah. If I kill them, I get the money. If I don't kill them, I gotta go work.
Well, sure.
That's terrible.
So a couple of days later, Neil said, he went by James's dorm room and Chris was there, and they talked about the plan. Chris said that after the murders, he would have to appear distraught and depressed. And the way he would come out of his depression, he said, was to go to the beach and to buy cars for all his friends. 3 or 4 days later, Neil said, he stopped by James's room, and he thought that it was on this visit that he found James putting black shoe polish on a pair of white gloves and on a wooden baseball bat. The handle was wrapped with black tape. James also showed Neil a new hunting knife he'd bought. He and Chris had bought it for the job, he told Neil. He said the knife was for backup because he planned to take out Chris's parents with the bat. One good blow on each ought to do it, James said, and took a swing of the bat in front of Neil.
It's just sick.
So this is a real sick fucker, isn't he?
Yeah, he certainly is. So 3 days after that, James came to Neil's apartment in the morning, gave him the keys to Chris's car, and told him to meet him in the parking lot behind the dorm that night between 11:30 and 12:30. So Neil remembered that James was wearing blue jeans with holes in the knees, a dark shirt over a white t-shirt, and the moccasin boots. He had brought along a black sweater, ski mask, dark trousers, and black tennis shoes to wear when he was in the house. James had slung a backpack over his shoulder that he usually used for carrying Dungeons and Dragons stuff. Neil recalled that James seemed to be hyperactive when they left for Washington. He was grinning a lot, Neil said. He didn't seem at all concerned at what he was going to be doing. Neil said that he never actually believed that anyone would be killed. He thought that James would go into the house, steal the jewelry, and leave. Well, you know what? That's just trying to minimize your involvement in this. Come on.
It is. It really is. I certainly believe that Neil felt pressured, like a peer pressure, and he was really stupid about it. But I also think this James was excited about this.
I'm worried about James. I really am.
Yeah. I mean, to him, it was like an adventure.
Yeah.
And he's the one where they really felt there was this connection with the D&D game, that he just liked this whole idea of fantasies and adventure. And maybe he wasn't quite seeing the difference between reality and fantasy. And I don't say that as an excuse, because I think he was a horrifically violent person. Just scary, really.
Yeah, well, the scary thing is, I mean, I don't think there was any past history of this kid.
I know, right? Not that we know of. So it's just scary to think some college kid out of the blue would be able to do such a horrible thing.
It's terrifying.
It really is.
So the two of them followed Chris's map to Smallwood, but they drove past it and they had to turn around and go back. Then they cased the neighborhood that included the darker and more isolated nearby roads out to the fairgrounds and airport. James smeared black shoe polish around his mouth and eyes, and he put on the dark ski mask. As Neil stopped at a wooded lot, James jumped out of the car with the backpack over his shoulder. He didn't look back as he ran into the trees toward the house. Neil was anxious as he waited in the dark for James to return. He started the car, turned toward town, and drove slowly looking for James. 15 minutes passed, and then he heard running feet on the pavement, turned to see James running toward him.
So James was happy. According to Neil, he said, "I actually did it. I don't ever want to see anything like that again. I never saw so much blood in my life." Neil told the officers that he saw blood on James's hands and clothing, and they drove away from town, going back the same route that they had come. On the way back to Raleigh, James told Neil to turn into a dirt lane by a field. Then James got out, changed his clothes, and asked Neil to open the trunk to put the weapons and the dirty clothing in. So that lane was muddy from an earlier thunderstorm, so the sides of the car got covered with mud. Somewhere west of Washington, James told him to turn onto a side road so that he could get rid of the clothing and the knife. They stopped by some woods on a curve, and that's where James piled the clothing on the road's shoulder along with the shoes, the knife, and the maps. He covered it all with gasoline from a can in the trunk and lit it on fire. So I guess he thought that was good enough. It would all burn to ash.
Yeah, but it didn't.
No. When they came into a town, James told Neil to stop for gas at an all-night convenience store, and Neil went in to pay. And while he was buying a soda and a candy bar, James came in and got a bottle of Gatorade and some beef jerky. And apparently James was just elated. He decided to take the car through an automatic car wash near the gas station, because they decided they couldn't take it back with all that mud on it. And at that point, James handed Neil 3 folded $20 bills and said, "Here, keep this." So we're thinking that came from Bonnie's purse.
Yeah, right? She had $120 in $20 bills?
Right. So it was just beginning to get light out, Neil said, when they got back to the college. And Neil drove back to the parking lot where he'd picked up the car and left it in the same spot. James told him to take the keys to Chris's room and leave them on a shelf in the utility closet in the bathroom. The next morning, Neil learned that Chris's mother had survived. So a 50% success for their mission was, of course, a total failure for what Chris was trying to accomplish.
Well, obviously, he's not going to be inheriting to share with his sister the estate.
Right.
Mom is.
He wouldn't be inheriting anything. So Neil and James would never be paid. Neil told the police that he never talked with Chris about the murder after it happened, and he only saw him a couple times after Chris returned to college that fall.
The big break in the case occurred when the hog farmer heard about the murder, and he reported a fire in the woods that early morning. When the area was searched, police found a hunting knife, some clothing, and a scrap of paper that had survived the fire that had the map of the Von Steins' house and neighborhood. Big-time stuff. Good evidence.
Well, it's pretty stupid to think a hunting knife will be destroyed in a small fire like that.
These guys are idiots anyway.
They are. Although James knew that the Washington police were trying to connect him to the Von Stein murder, he was really kind of strangely confident that they had no evidence against him and thought he wouldn't get arrested. He went into hiding with the girl that he had been seeing, and he was able to avoid being caught for a while. A patrolman from the North Carolina State Public Safety Department had been driving on a campus street when he spotted James Upchurch. He was a tall, thin young man with long brown hair, and the patrolman had been alerted to be on the lookout for a former NC State student named James Bartlett Upchurch, who was wanted for questioning about a murder. So James was picked up, and he initially gave a false name. He was taken, actually, to a suite of rooms in the local Holiday Inn, where he was handcuffed to a chair, and several agents tried to get him to talk. Neil had told them everything, they said, and they had even found the bat, which wasn't true. They said they knew that Chris had put him up to it, and they wanted him to tell them about Chris. So they're trying to make him feel like Chris will be the one in trouble here, not him.
Exactly. So James was taken to the police department. He's photographed and fingerprinted, and then he was moved to a jail in the basement of the courthouse. Both the police and the district attorney wanted to keep his arrest a secret because they didn't want to tip off Chris. James was taken into a district courtroom where he was quickly arraigned and had a lawyer appointed for him. He was charged with conspiracy to commit murder, assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, and first-degree burglary and felonious larceny.
Well, despite the efforts to keep James' arrest a secret, a friend from Washington called Bonnie to tell her that a friend of Chris's had been arrested for murdering Leith. A young woman who had dated Chris was a receptionist in the town hall, apparently, and her mother was a secretary to a local attorney.
Jeez.
So word gets out.
Word gets out. Lots of different ways.
Yeah. Chris had spent the previous night at a friend's house, and Bonnie called him there. "Chris, you need to come home and sit with me," she told him, "because things are happening." Now, Bonnie was polite and unemotional, and she told the police that she couldn't understand why they were doing this to her family. They were making a big mistake. But Chris seemed nervous. He was compliant when he was served the warrant, and he was put into handcuffs.
So Neil, Chris, and James ended up in separate cell blocks so they couldn't communicate with each other. A month after their arrests, the Von Stein murder was still pretty big news in Washington. Then on Wednesday, July 12th, the residents of Beaufort County learned the motive with a newspaper headline that said, "Murdered Von Stein left $2 million." Now, quoting probate documents, the newspaper set the value of his estate at $1,940,206.92.
Oh, you're very specific, Dick. I like that in a man.
I got to be precise. This included life insurance of $770,000, all of which was left to Bonnie. The report went on to say that if Bonnie had died in the attack, her children would have inherited everything.
That's a lot of money.
That is. $2 million.
It's life-changing money. So you could see why that would be a motive for someone who's callous and
absolutely
has no regard for human life. So the trial of James Upchurch began in January of 1990. Chris had admitted to planning the murder, and Neil Henderson pleaded guilty to reduced charges as part of a plea bargain. And they both testified against James Upchurch. Upchurch continued to deny all the charges, but he was found guilty of first-degree murder, assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill, conspiracy to commit murder, and burglary in the first degree. He was sentenced to death, but then his death sentence was set aside on October 1st of 1992, and he was resentenced to life in prison. But here's the scary thing, Dick. He's eligible for parole in 2022, and that's coming up.
It certainly is.
And he's a scary guy. I hope he's gotten some help.
He is. This guy, kind of out of the blue, agrees to do this. I'd be very worried that he's going to do something again.
Yeah, this isn't even someone who he was angry with.
I know.
And to do that violent crime against two people he didn't even really know. I don't want to meet him when he's out. Maybe he won't get out.
Well, he won't find his way here anyway. So Chris Pritchard was convicted of aiding and abetting in second-degree murder, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. And then he also received a 20-year sentence for aiding and abetting the assault on his mother, Bonnie. Now, he's already been released on parole. This is in 2007.
Yeah, he's been out a while, and I guess he's a born again.
So he's minding himself.
Yeah, whatever, you know, keeps you in line, I say. Neil Henderson was also convicted of murder in the second degree, aiding and abetting, and of aiding and abetting the assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill or seriously injure. He was sentenced to 40 years in prison, and he was paroled way back in 2000. So he only spent, what, less than 10 years?
Yeah.
Now here's the thing that just shocks me, is Bonnie reconciled with her son Chris before his trial in 1990, and Bonnie and Chris remain close. He did admit to planning it, so I'm guessing he confessed everything to her and they've worked it out.
Well, that's remindful of the case we did, or episode we did a while ago. The kid who tried to kill both his parents, but his mother survived.
And oh, yeah. His name was Chris, too, wasn't it?
I think.
Yeah.
And initially, she identified him as the perpetrator and then said, no, it wasn't.
Yes, you're right. Yeah. But that's different because he didn't admit it. And she thinks he's innocent. But true. In Bonnie's case, she knows that Chris did it.
Yes, she does.
Yeah, which I just can't imagine that. That's horrible.
Now, the case and the trial were the subject of two books. Joe McGinnis wrote Cruel Doubt. McGinnis, if you recall, was the one who wrote about Jeffrey McDonald's crime called Fatal Vision.
Yep.
And then there was Jerry Bledsoe's book, Blood Games. They were both published in 1991. Bledsoe's book was adapted for television as Honor Thy Mother, and McGinnis's Cruel Doubt was adapted as a two-part miniseries of the same name. Both books and television films focused a lot on the killer's interest in the game Dungeons & Dragons, which they sometimes acted out with real weapons in the steam tunnels on their college campus. This all occurred while they were under the influence of drugs and alcohol. And detectives also found that Chris had used LSD.
But the one who actually physically did the murder, James, there's no indication that he was high or drunk or anything. This was just who he was.
Yep.
Scary. And despite the fact that I did call this the Dungeons & Dragons murder, it seems to me that the game had little or nothing to do with the murder, an attempted murder of Chris's parents. The only thing about the game from my point of view is that playing the game is how the young men spent much of their time together and kind of bonded over it. And the murder itself was done for money, at least for Chris, but like we said, James seemed to enjoy this adventure. And it makes me think maybe it was more connected to the game for him. He just wanted the adventure of this brutality, really. As for Neil, he seemed to be a follower who wouldn't speak up for himself, and maybe he tried to convince himself that the plan was not real, but more of a fantasy or a game. But when you're actually in the car driving there with weapons, that's the time to say, hey, no, this is getting too real.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I've never played the game. I had to look it up.
Well, you're too young.
I don't think so. No, I think that it was right in my time when this game got popular. But I appreciate it. Well, apparently the game has received some very negative coverage, especially back in the 80s. Because the term D&D may be mistakenly used to refer to all types of role-playing games, some controversies regarding it actually pertain to role-playing games in general, not just Dungeons & Dragons. But, you know, the authorities did focus on Chris's role-playing group after a game map with the Von Stein house turned up as physical evidence. So there's some talk that they did talk about this murder as a mission, as one of their games would be.
So, and there was some attention given to James Upchurch's influence and power as a dungeon master.
Right, so that was a big thing in the game too.
Yeah, and then at that time, D&D was a topic tied to the era's kind of satanic panic viewpoint.
Sure. So that was focused on regardless. But I do kind of see it with James. If he's really into this game and there are violent things going on, he's just taking it another step further.
That's right.
So our sources for this episode include the two books that Dick mentioned, as well as the North Carolina Department of Public Safety and the Raleigh News Observer archives. TCB's music was written and produced by Tristan Capel. If you enjoy listening to our shows, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or wherever you're listening. It really helps us to find new listeners. If you visit our website, tiegrabber.com, you'll find a shopping page where you can buy some brewery merch. We have teas, tanks, and warm, soft hoodies as this cooler weather's moving in this autumn. And now we also have cloth masks to keep you safe and declare your TCB love to the public. So, Dick, what did you bring us for feedback today?
Well, I have a couple emails. I did have a couple voicemails also, one from Karen and one from Michelle, that were quite complimentary. And I know how you hate listening to compliments about yourself, so I didn't play them. So we're going to be not exactly stuck, but we're going to do two emails.
Sounds good to me.
The first one is from Barbara. This is on YouTube. And she had a case suggestion. She wanted us to look into the death of an author named Helen Bailey. And it's fascinating. I think we'll do more than look into it.
Okay.
So she was an author of children's books, and her husband was a guy named John Sinfield. They were on vacation in the Barbados in 2011. John went for a swim and got caught in a riptide and drowned. Helen started a website called Planet Grief to help her deal with her loss, and through this website met a guy named Ian Stewart, and they got together. They became engaged in 2016. That April in 2016, Helen took her dachshund Boris out for a walk, and the two disappeared. Ian, when questioned by the police, said Helen had gone away for a few days, but she didn't return. And then in July of 2016, they found Helen and Boris's bodies dead in a septic tank on the property that they owned.
Huh. So is Ian the suspect without giving it all away?
Ian's the suspect, and I'm not going to give it away.
Okay.
But we're going to look into that.
That's an interesting one. Thank you, Barbara. Then Leanne has a case suggestion, and Leanne wrote, "Hello, I was wondering if you have ever heard of this case. I was born and raised in West Virginia, about an hour away from Shelley's hometown, and of course, every West Virginia native knows about Morgantown."
Yeah, the university's there.
"I've only seen this case on one other podcast. I thought maybe this would interest you both, especially since there are a lot of medical elements with how she committed this crime. She was a nurse. Thanks for taking the time to read my message and keep up the great work. I have read a book about this case and it is very good."
Okay. And the brief synopsis of this is that Shelley Angus, who's a nurse and a mother of two, and a guy named Jimmy Michael, who is a therapist and a father of two, had an affair. They met at work. They divorced their spouses and married each other. Then on November 28, 2005, Shelley went to work one day and Jimmy was staying at home in bed because it was early. Somehow a fire started and Jimmy died in the fire.
So we think that the nurse drugged him and set the house on fire? Is that what we're getting at?
Bingo.
I've seen too much of this stuff.
You've been reading in too much of this stuff. That's
right.
But yeah, that looked like a good case too.
Okay. Those are great case suggestions. These are ones I've never heard of. And I really would like to start getting into some lesser-known cases. It's always interesting, I feel, like for listeners to hear a case they've never heard of before. Although they're very kind and patient and always compliment us on the job we do, even if they've heard of a case. To me, it would be doing more of a service to do some lesser-known cases, not only for our listeners, but for the victims who really just get lost in the shuffle.
Well, that's right. I mean, the famous ones everybody's heard about.
Yes. And some of them are irresistible to cover, of course.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
But I'm never sure about how much we add to them.
Exactly.
If anything.
Right. Well, we always add our charm and all
true.
That to it. So there's always that.
Our suaveness.
Yes, exactly.
Suaveness, suavity.
Let's stick with charm.
Charm's good.
Okay. All right. Well, any other things to say today, Dick?
No, there's still some beer left, and since we're not going anyplace, let's finish it.
All right. A beer and a nap sound good to me.
There you are. See?
All right. And it's October, so scary movie season. Looking forward to that. Maybe we'll do a little episode on a scary movie for Halloween. That's always fun.
Oh, yeah. Well, we did Halloween
a while ago. We did the original and the new one, I think, with Jamie Lee.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah, so let's find another one this year.
So that might be something to do.
Yeah, if you're sending in a case suggestion and there's a horror movie you'd like us to cover, we would welcome your suggestions on that as well.
There you go.
All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. We really appreciate it. We hope everyone is staying safe and happy.
Exactly.
So we will see you next time at the Quiet End.
Bye, guys.
Bye-bye.